The Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee. Every coffee lover knows that the key to the best coffee is fresh roasted beans. Most coffee you buy in the grocery store or your local coffee shop was roasted months before it got to you. Sparkplug Coffee is roasted to order in Toronto and delivered right to your door anywhere in Canada while the coffee is fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug offers plenty of variety and grinds to suit any taste. Their scientific roast process ensures consistency so that each blend maintains its flavor profile. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in by going to sparkplug.coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
You're right, opening theme music. It's the Top 100 Project, and thanks to you for tuning us in. What we have here is an analysis of the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 100 most outstanding American films. Spoilers are in your immediate future, so tune to something else if you want the secrets to remain secrets. I am Ryan Ellis, joined by my bickering bride, Bev.
That's me.
We're also joined by the panter from the Old West, old Cowboy Fox, the dog in the corner.
Yeah, he's hot.
All right, so the coming attraction trivia for this week's film, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? The first two movies Mike Nichols directed, this one and The Graduate, made the Top 100. How many other Nichols pictures were nominated for the Top 100?
I'm going to guess zero, because while he's made some rather beloved films, none of them are critical darlings.
Yeah, this is one of my trick questions. The answer was none.
Oh, I'm so smart.
I was surprised. I thought something would be, but I looked through his list. You know what I think he might be? The Spencer Tracy of directors.
Mm-hmm.
Very good at his craft, but didn't necessarily have that many films. Okay, one for sure. We're about to talk about it in seconds. But other than that, not a lot of films that I loved all that much. Spencer Tracy, with his own career as well, I would put him in that class.
He has a lot of really well-liked films. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody really likes Working Girl and The Birdcage, and these are all films that people are really fond of, but nobody's ever going to think of them when they compile a list of greatest films ever made. But I feel like Working Girl is still probably something a lot of people will put on a Sunday afternoon.
That's right? Still pretty popular. Silkwood. Mm-hmm. I see you have a list over there. That's one of them. And we're going to cover it in a few weeks. The Graduate.
Yes.
Which is definitely beloved. Not one of my very favorites. That's what I'm saying, though.
Mm-hmm. But it's like he struck gold twice, and he struck silver many times after that. I mean, he made a few bombs, too. But...
I liked Closer. That was the second to last movie. His last movie was Charlie Wilson's War.
Mm-hmm.
Not that he's dead. He can still make more movies, but this is the last one he made.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked Closer, with the TV movie with Emma Thompson. And hey, Primary Colors. That may be one of my very favorites of all of his films.
Oh yeah, I forgot to mention that.
But not
one.
A great movie.
But a lot of people really liked it.
Mm-hmm. And yet, nothing else but Virginia Woolf and The Graduate were even on the Top 100 nominees list. And Fox agrees. That's probably enough for Mike Nichols.
Well, it's two more movies on the list than I have.
One day we're going to have seven or eight of our own. That's not going to happen. Okay, so the 69th edition of the Top 100 Project, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, didn't have a spot on AFI's 1998 Top 100. Egads! Although it was among the 400 nominees. Then it ranked 67th on the 2007 list, between Raiders of the Lost Ark, one of Bev's favorites, and Unforgiven. Virginia Woolf was released by Warner Brothers at the beginning of summer on June 22nd, 1966, our only film from 66. Like so many AFIers, this picture made money hand over fist over the other hand. And Bev will describe this very simple story for you right now with a skinny.
Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor are George and Martha, an unhappily married New England teacher and headmaster's daughter. Following a party, they invite Nick and Honey, played by George Segal and Sandy Dennis, over for late-night drinks. The hosts don't play nice. In fact, their verbiage is more vicious than most shooting wars. Bring on the booze and the barbed banter.
Or in a nutshell, if you're a handsome young man invited to George and Martha's for late night drinks, bring a condom. Especially if you're a social climber who's going to sleep with her for probably all the wrong reasons. Okay, 97% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes, only one rotten review of the ones that are on there, and 91% of audiences like this movie. And I know you did, but let's hear you gush about it right now.
So, if you know any arty teenagers, you know that all arty teenagers have some obsession, like the Velvet Underground or Bob Dylan or Kurosawa or something. But mine was Edward Albee, who's the playwright. I was crazy about Edward Albee. I read any play of his I could get my hands on, which wasn't a fair amount because it was the 90s and it was before the internet. But everything I could, I was so into him, and I loved this play, and I saw it on stage, and I owned the movie on VHS and watched it many times. And I was worried that as an adult, I wouldn't like it as much. Teenagers have a flair for the melodramatic, and this film is certainly melodramatic, so I was really worried that I would go back and revisit it, and it would be embarrassing to remember that I liked something, like, embarrassed for my teenage taste. But gratefully, not only do I still love this film, but I think I love it more now that I'm older and I can understand its nuances better.
Now that we're like George and Martha.
And now that I'm in a truly horrifically toxic marriage, I can really relate on a different level that I couldn't relate to when I was 17, 18 years old. The film really... The film definitely, I still would say it flirts with overkill, like it's bordering on histrionic, but it's always saved by that masterpiece of a script and the very nuanced performances. So it remains one of my favorites. And I look forward to watching it when I'm George and Martha's age to see how I appreciate it then. When our marriage has surely become just a tragic battleground. Scars that will never heal.
And you invite over the young George Segal-esque man to sleep with at some point at about 4 or 5 in the morning. After a lot of booze. That's one thing about this film. We're seeing four people who are blitzed. Three of whom play it very well. The other one who plays it quite well, that being Segal. I think he's not as convincing as a drunk, although maybe he's just playing a guy who doesn't show it as much.
Yeah, he seems to come and go a little bit.
But Sandy Dennis plays it, I think, pretty well, that whole over-the-top obnoxious thing. She's probably very nice and fun. I don't know about charming, but nice and fun when she's just sober. Mm-hmm. But in this film, she's irritating.
Yeah, she has this kind of interesting position that she's in because she's the only character that, on that night, never really does anything unforgivable. She isn't awful the way the other three of them are, so it would be really easy to feel so sorry for her and victimize her that it would kind of spoil enjoying the nuance of all the horrible things that everybody else is doing to each other. But she plays it so annoying that by the end of the film, you're just like, oh yeah, I would hate being married to you too.
But she has one key moment, though, and that is when she's coming back down from the washroom and she stops on the staircase just for a moment, and she overhears something. And I think maybe that 1 or 2 seconds is the key to her whole character. That maybe she's putting things on, both as a drunk, and we never see her sober. We never see any of these people sober. But we can only imagine what they're like that way. And I have a feeling that she's just playing it nice for this guy because she feels like that's her job. It's the mid-60s, and that's what wives are supposed to do. But that one look on her face, it's almost like I've resigned myself. Okay, hello everyone, how's it going? What are we doing now? Let's have fun.
And it's certainly a pronounced theme of the film that people bend over backwards and work their butts off to put forward that idea of the perfect nuclear family. And the film is kind of all about tearing that down and showing it, revealing it for the farce that it is.
Nuclear family, here's a big spoiler, and I talked about secrets earlier, but here's a huge spoiler if you haven't seen this movie. There are no kids, despite the fact that it's often discussed that George and Martha have one. I almost said it. What is the age of that non-existent child?
It's his 16th birthday following day, which I guess was that day, because it was the middle of the night.
But they've made him up as some story. Now, here's a compelling part of this movie. That comes to a head at the end. We find out when Burton finally reveals that they never had a son and they've been lying about it all night long. The question I have is, how many times has this played out before with other people? And will this play out again with other people in the future?
Well, yeah, because the son is a fantasy, so I don't see why there's so much finality in him killing him.
Well, you know what? I have to remind myself that George says that when Martha talks about him to anybody else, to Honey, that's when the gloves come off. So maybe this fake child they may have been talking about just amongst each other for many years was never discussed with anyone else, but now it has been.
But you get the impression that they talked about this fake child with so much detail and passion that it was a convincing delusion, especially for Martha. It's suggested by many people that both George and Martha are suffering from bipolar disorder, which can go along with some rather severe hallucinations sometimes. So maybe the idea is she's convinced herself that this son exists and he always plays along with it. And so it would actually be somewhat convincing for him. Plus, you know, he could kill the son simply by saying, I am never going to go along with this ever again.
What will the next fantasy be with the next couple? Because you get the feeling that George and Martha, now we said unhappily married. Maybe they're not. Maybe this is their version of happiness. Them digging at each other.
Well, she says, he makes me happy even though I don't want to be happy. They're kind of happy miserable.
By being bickering bride and groom.
Yeah, and they definitely really need each other.
And what is the one moment they seem united? At least when the couple is over there. It's this. After she's had the affair with Nick upstairs. And that's when George and Martha are literally in a two-shot looking at him as if, who are you, punk?
Oh, yeah. It's such a great moment because everything turns around because they're united against a common enemy, which is Nick. And when they turn on him and they direct both of their very great acerbic wit onto Nick, it is just like a nuclear bomb going off and he is not prepared.
And it's implied that he couldn't perform upstairs because he's too drunk, probably. That's certainly a very understandable reason. It's also probably 5 a.m. by this point.
Yeah.
The movie is almost set in real time. It's about an hour and a half away from being real time because when does the movie start? What time of day? What time of night?
2 a.m.
2 a.m. We overhear them saying that as they come out of the party.
Boy, I better not miss any of these trivia questions after all that talk I had.
Here's another one. Right. I think I'm right. I hope I didn't miss this. Very famously, this movie has four actors, all four nominated for the acting Oscars. That doesn't happen very often. But there are two other people that are uncredited. How many other people do we see in this movie at some point? Other human beings?
None.
No, we definitely see two others.
We do?
An aficionado of this movie should know. The Roadhouse Manager.
Yeah, the Roadhouse Manager and his wife.
There are two others.
What, is there somebody else when walking they're leaving, when the they're party. Leaving the party? Yeah. Oh, so okay, couple. Some extras in the background.
Well, I'm being extremely specific. I don't think we see another human soul the entire rest of the movie.
Okay, fine. You're just trying to stump me.
But still, a four-person cast. Another trivia question. The guy who plays the Roadhouse Manager is a tech guy in the crew. What was his job on the crew?
Oh, best boy? Gaffer?
Gaffer.
Yeah, gaffer.
He was the gaffer.
You know, something like that. Okay, I have a question for you.
All right.
In the movie, they make references to lots of other movies, and they directly name the title of another AFI movie. You know what it is.
Would it be Bringing Up Baby?
It would. The name of the last game they play.
Yeah, a movie we covered so long ago. All right, so the film is almost a bottle episode. We've had two other movies that were almost bottle episodes as well. We talked about that when we did those, Rear Window and 12 Angry Men. This one isn't quite because we do go out on the town, the roadhouse, and all that stuff. But the play is a bottle episode. It is only in their living room.
Yeah, the play doesn't even have the yard or anything else. I don't think it has the bedroom. That was one of the few big-ish changes they made, was to take the four of them out to the roadhouse just to get a change of scenery. I think it was something cinematic to do because the play is not very cinematic, right? It's just four people arguing.
I don't know much about the theater, but I'm guessing an awful lot of plays have been bottle episodes.
Oh, sure, because you're restricted so much by the set. So it's very helpful to keep everything in as few locations as possible.
Well, tell us more about Albie, because I don't know much about him. If he's ever written anything else that's ever been adapted for a movie, I'm not aware of it.
I don't think anything else he's ever written has been adapted for a movie. A lot of the other stuff he's written is very weird. His most famous plays would have been...
Well, while you discuss this, I'll look it up. What are you talking?
His most famous plays other than... I mean, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is hands down his most famous play, but... He also wrote The Zoo Story. That was his first. American Dream is rather famous. It's much weirder than this and much ruder and more off-putting than this. I think a lot of his films kind of are more gutsy. Gutsier, like this is actually a conventional work by his standards. Delicate Balance. He won Pulitzer Prize for Three Tall Women and something else that I can't remember right now. He was a master of the theater of the absurd. He was one of the playwrights that really brought this style of theater into the mainstream, along with Beckett and Eugene Ionesco. Theater of the absurd, the whole idea is it's very nihilistic. They were very interested in expressing what happens when human existence has no meaning or purpose. So that's always one of the driving forces of the characters and the plots in their story, is that they're seeking meaning, but there is none to be found.
Very Waiting for Godot-esque, maybe.
Well, yeah, and Beckett was definitely a theater of the absurd.
That's right. He was the Waiting for Godot, of course. Yeah.
Virginia Woolf, I think it played off-Broadway first. It was one of the first real theater of the absurd plays to play on Broadway. People found it outrageously vulgar. It was shocking, and they said it could never be filmed, but that was in 1962. Of course, I don't think people realize how quickly Hollywood was changing. The production code was just falling apart at that point. You know, we've talked about this before.
This is one of the movies that helped bring it down.
Oh, yeah,
Blow
certainly.
Up. Antonio Blow Up, which we talked about last week when we did Dr. Zhivago. Those are two of the ones that really contributed to the production code going bye-bye.
They replaced their yes-no system with a rating system. When Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf came out, they had warnings on the ads, and they prompted theaters to restrict it to 18 and over unless accompanied by parents. But that was like one of the first times that they did that.
You said theater, and you're talking movie theaters, but the theater, Broadway, the language was even risque and controversial for that.
Oh, definitely.
And you can get away with more there than at that point, at least, than you could in the movies.
The language was worse in the play. When sure. she says, God damn you, in the movie, what they're really saying in the play was, screw you. Mm. And for the 2005 revival, they upgraded it to F you.
Oh, I'm not surprised there. Yeah. They do say bugger and hump in this one. Hump the hostess, they say that several times. And he says the word bugger. This is unlike any movie we've covered so far. We've covered some mature movies, Manchurian Candidate, and some of the concepts in Dr. Strangelove, Citizen Kane, extremely ahead of its time. But this one is really starting to help set a new tone, for sure, in the movies.
I feel like it has a lot of similarities with Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah, but they didn't get with the language. And, of course, this is 15 years later.
Yes, it's a definitely more risky version of that. And Martha is a whole different character than Stella or Blanche.
Yeah, because maybe not physically, but verbally, she fights back hard.
Oh, yeah, she is mean. It's pretty hard to pick sides in this, and George is far from innocent. But he does come across as the victim.
He doesn't seem henpecked. He seems too strong and smart for that. But he's about as close to that as a guy who is strong and smart could be. Seems like she probably always, in some way, is beating on him. When they're sober, maybe it's a lot more subtle. And maybe it's not even really there in the same way. When they're drunk, obviously it comes out full bore. But there is one nice moment in the bedroom. We talked about when they're united later at the end of the night when they're blitzed. And she's already had an affair with Nick moments before. But before Nick and Honey even come over, they're in the bedroom and he says something and they both laugh. I could actually see in that moment a great opportunity for those two, meaning Burton and Taylor, to have done a romantic comedy together. They might have been very funny, because they are funny at times in this movie, but I mean funny as in, let's be funny for an hour and a half, rather than let's be barbed and angry, and then sometimes be funny.
Yeah, couples can't always pull this off on screen when they're couples in real life, but they have insane chemistry together. Chemistry in their love and chemistry in their hate. Let's face it, the two are not that far apart.
Let's get specific about Burton and Taylor. Their real marriage definitely infused the story with even more spark than you could even say was necessary for this movie. They also got divorced and remarried more than once. Now, I think at this point they were still considered happy, but later on they weren't, of course, and I'm sure it wasn't exactly a pleasant sort of, nice to be with you, see you later, is probably kind of like what we see in this movie. I'm not going to imply anything beyond the yelling and screaming, because they do get physical in this movie. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But anyway, they did have some stormy times. They made 11 movies together. This was number 4. They had met on Cleopatra. And much like Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, who are today's version of these two, I would say, although Pitt and Jolie are still married and happy. In fact, they just got married very recently and have a bunch of kids together.
They seem to have a much less cantankerous relationship.
And have not made another movie together since they met on Mr. and Mrs. Smith. But they also met in a movie when one or both of them was with someone else and had an on-set affair. And then things went from there, because that happened to Burton and Taylor in Cleopatra. A movie that we've mentioned many times, actually.
Yes, yeah, true.
Considering it's not anywhere near being on this list. But it did set a lot of tones, and it was 63, just a couple years before this. Taylor got paid a lot of money for that movie. That was one of the reasons why it was controversial. She started getting to be flighty, like Brando got to be flighty, unreliable. And she made $1 million for this film. She thought this was her best performance. I absolutely agree. And if she's going to make $1 million for anything, this is the one she deserved it for.
All four of them are incredible. Some of the best performances we've seen. I know I say that a lot, because we've seen a lot of really amazing performances by some of the best actors in Hollywood at the top of their game. I think Burton probably pulls ahead of...
Oh, he's the best thing in the cast. Yeah, I was going to say that next.
He's absolutely incredible. What he does with George, the amount of nuance and depth he puts into every word, and even just that he delivers that beautiful, witty language, and he gets it perfectly. He just gets it and gets it. Oh my God, it's so much fun to watch him do everything he does in this film.
He's also the only one of the cast who has individual scenes with all three other actors. The only other time we see anybody else on screen without at least one other person is briefly we see Martha and Nick together after they've had the affair, because, of course, George is out looking for those flowers to come in. And what he says is something about flowers for the dead, which I think is supposed to be an homage to Streetcar, because he also does his Brando-esque, "Oh, Martha, I got you, Deej."
Ah.
I think that's what he's doing there. But in any case, George is the only one who spends significant time with, of course, Martha, but also with Nick outside, and then even a little bit with Honey towards the end.
You get all the best revelations from him.
Sure.
He detests everybody's illusions, and he's always trying to needle them and get them to admit the lies that they're telling to him, that they're telling to themselves. But he holds on to his own illusions very tightly. He never really wants to own up to the fact that he's disappointed in himself for not advancing further in his career.
What is his job? What's his profession?
He's an associate history professor.
Right.
And what does Nick teach?
He's a math teacher. No, no, no. He's in biology.
He's in biology.
Over and over and over again, they have to go back to that well.
But George, who's clearly the smartest guy in the room, it's in the company of him that we learn the true nature of Nick and Honey's marriage and why they got married, about their own little imaginary baby, the hysterical pregnancy.
That's right.
And then it's later, when Honey is completely plastered with George again, she kind of reveals maybe it wasn't a hysterical pregnancy. It's suggested that her drunken ramblings when she's saying, I don't want a child, I don't want to be a mother, was that she had an abortion. It's the suggestion there.
And earlier in that outside scene with Siegel and Burton, when they're by the swing drinking together for quite a long time, they're alone together. George let slip that they never had any kids either. He says something more along the lines of Martha couldn't have kids either.
One thing Martha's never been is pregnant.
But Nick doesn't pick up on it.
No.
That's also fairly early, fairly early in their night. So Nick wouldn't necessarily need to realize that this is part of a lie. And it's only later on. He's also the one that says, I think I get this now. I finally get this now.
Over and over.
We talk about their names so much here. Honey. I don't think they're ever actually introduced, because why would they be? They were introduced an hour or so before. Well, probably hours before. But Nick is always calling her Honey. I wonder if she actually has a name, Sally or Betsy or something, and they're calling her Honey because that's what he's calling her.
Oh, that's a good question.
Their names are rarely said. Nick and Honey are rarely said. They are
Nick
a few times.
Nick is never said. Is it? I don't think anybody ever says his name.
Okay. George and Martha are many times by them, but the other two, not much at all.
No. I feel like Honey is definitely her name.
Her actual name? Okay.
Yeah.
Not that that matters. I just think that's an interesting little twist.
Well, it's interesting even that her name is Honey. It's such a strange name, and it's a generic term of endearment.
Or if I'm right, that she doesn't even get an actual name, just demeans her even more and puts her down on an even lower pedestal, her character.
She could have been so bland, but she's not. And her and Martha, they share, you know, in common, not just their imaginary children, but also their overbearing and far too impressive fathers. They talk about daddy so much.
Yeah.
They talk about daddy almost as much as they talk about the kid.
Now, the obvious connection here is the two bickering couples. Will the younger one end up like the older one? I would say it's unlikely because I don't think that Honey has it in her to ever be like Martha. Maybe, but I don't think so. I mean, we're talking what's supposed to be 20 or 30 years. Now, there's one interesting wrinkle on this, too. Taylor was not very old yet. She was still a pretty young person. We talked about how young she was in A Place in the Sun. This is only 15 years later? Yeah, 15 years later.
I think she was 32 or 33.
But it's makeup and it's her attitude. And also one of those things, too, I read some reviews that kind of criticize that it doesn't really hide her beauty. Maybe that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
Is that this woman was a stunner. She wasn't Elizabeth Taylor. I'm talking about the character now. But she was a stunner in their little world in New England. But she's gone to sea because she's drinking too much. She's eating too much. She doesn't care about herself much anymore because she doesn't have an actual child. And she's with this guy that she has this love-hate relationship with. So she was the town beauty who isn't anymore.
And she has to be the kind of person that could get away with having a personality that acerbic. You know, you get the impression that Nick is not the first person that she's cheated on George with.
Yeah.
She certainly seems to pride herself on her ability to seduce a man. And she seems very confident about it as well, you know. She's wearing tight-fitting clothes. She's dancing. She's got her flirt on, you know. She feels like she's a beautiful woman. And she probably was a beautiful young woman. She probably was a hot mess. And that's part of why George fell in love with her.
But I think Nick is doing this for all the wrong reasons. He might be attracted to her, and as we're saying, she's not unattractive by any means, and maybe he's just too drunk to withstand her charms, but I think he's doing it because he wants to move his career ahead.
Yeah, he definitely wants to endear. I mean, the reason they're there at all is because of his career.
And is invited to the party, their post-party, by her. It wasn't by both of them.
You don't say
George
no.
George didn't even know about it.
Yeah, you don't say no to the boss's daughter. And she takes advantage of that. She takes care to remind them that they have to keep her happy. And part of the reason that they don't leave when any normal couple would have walked out of there a long time ago is because they can't insult Martha.
Yeah.
And so maybe part of it is that he doesn't want to insult her, or that he thinks that it'll curry some favor with her father, what have you. And probably part of it, like you said, is just that she's drunk and she's all over him and he's drunk and she's still a sexy woman.
Right away when they're sitting down, she puts her hand on his leg. Not that it's over the top. She doesn't go too far into his crotch or anything. But she puts her hand on his leg in a way that's maybe not the most appropriate. And right from the start, maybe George knows at that point that this is going to happen. Although interesting that she sleeps with this guy in their bedroom. And when we see the bedroom earlier, when it's George and Martha, one bed. We've seen a few movies, Giant, they had the two beds. Now that was also 10 years before this film. And as we're saying, this movie changed everything. So of course, why wouldn't that be part of it too? But add that to the list of things that make a big change. We're not seeing this quaint little thing in the 50s where we sleep in our own little twin bed, 4 feet away from each other. No, there's one bed in there.
Speaking of Giant, remember how awful the age makeup was in Giant?
On Elizabeth Taylor.
And then, I know, and then you look at her in this film, and you're like, that's how it's done. That's how you age somebody.
Yeah, because I think we're agreeing that even if the makeup isn't absolute state-of-the-art, makeup was still something they were still trying to figure their way out. We're 2 years away from a movie we covered on the Not 100 Project a few months ago, Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
With its legendary makeup. Mm-hmm. But that was also full face makeup. Trying to make someone who's not old and unattractive look older and unattractive, or at least less attractive, is probably a harder task.
When I was younger and I used to watch this movie all the time, because I didn't really know how old she was, I just wasn't familiar with Liz Taylor that much, except for this movie, I just thought that was her age. Mm-hmm. I was completely convinced. I remember knowing that she had put weight on for the role, but I didn't realize that she was in her 40s.
Well, as we said, they're all brilliant. So, all four were nominated for Oscars. Two of them won. We'll talk about the entire Oscar list at the end. But the two were the women. And Burton was shafted. It's unfortunate because as great as Taylor is and as good as the other two are, this is the best thing I think Burton ever did. His only AFI film, he was in The Robe. A big hit, actually. When we talk so much about Box Office Mojo, the adjusted for inflation list, that is up there. I don't remember what number it was, but it's way up there.
Really?
It's a movie about Jesus' robe. That's why it's called that.
Oh.
He was also in Cleopatra with Elizabeth Taylor. And by the way, I've heard this story for years now. Don't call her Liz. She always hated that.
Really?
Yeah. Whenever they say Dick and Liz, she resented that.
Boy, she would hate being around today. They would call her, like, Elte. They would give them some terrible couple name.
Oh, for sure. These two, because they were in the movies together and married for so long, and controversial couple. Burton was also in Beckett with Peter O'Toole, and his last film was 1984, the adaptation of that classic novel. Hmm. And then he died prematurely. He was a hardcore alcoholic, so this movie was in some ways method for him, although he wasn't a method actor, I don't think.
Taylor went to rehab as well, so they must have been pretty familiar with that.
And as talented as he was, as great as he was in this film, I said already about Spencer Tracy, there was a great actor. Not a lot of films I really truly loved, though. I would say that was true also about Burton, apart from this one. Taylor's got her third AFI film here. She buzzes in A Place in the Sun and Giant, two movies we've already mentioned on this podcast, neither of which you loved, and I thought were fine. I must have. I bought them a long time ago. This is so many leaps and bounds different.
Her character's so much more interesting in this film. She gets to play something other than the pretty one, you know, the object of desire.
Yeah, she's got more character in each film as they go along.
That's true, yeah, because Giant, she's...
And she is probably... Well, I said at the time I thought that Rock Hudson was the best thing in Giant, but she's right with him.
Mm-hmm.
And she was never recognized for those two films. Not that the Oscars are the be-all and end-all, but those two movies. There were a lot of nominations in A Place in the Sun and Giant for other actors, but not for her. And finally, she gets her just desserts in this film.
She uglied herself up, that's why. You put on weight for a role, you ugly yourself up. Oh, that's... Oscar loves
true.
That.
True. I bet if she looked as good as she always did, though, how could you overlook her for this film?
Yeah.
As for Siegel and Dennis, George Siegel on the AFI film also was this one. He was in Bloom and Love in the 70s and California Split, pretty solid film that Robert Altman made. One thing we're going to start getting now as we get into this era, the late 60s, early 70s, is that actors will often work with Robert Altman in one film or many films. We talked about Altman when we did Julie Christie and Dr. Zhivago last week. Well, here's another guy who worked with him. Siegel's been in the business for 53 years, and he's still going. Burton and Taylor, Burton especially, are now long gone. Burton died in, I guess it was 84.
Mm-hmm.
And Sandy Dennis in this film, her only AFI picture, she was also in The Out-of-Towners with Jack Lemmon.
I would be curious to see her in a film where she's not playing the most annoying person in the room.
She's like pretty annoying in that.
Aggressively annoying person.
She's pretty annoying in
that. Oh, yeah?
As far as other people could have been in the movies, we've talked about this on almost every podcast, especially lately. George and Nick might have been Jack Lemmon and Robert Redford.
Yeah.
Yeah, Redford had the blonde thing going. He actually looks a lot like Siegel. He's better looking than Siegel.
Jack
at that
Lemmon
point.
As George?
Yeah, I love Lemmon, but I don't know if he could have pulled it off.
He's too likable.
Maybe that would have been the point for him, is to go against that grain.
Yeah.
I recently watched Cool Hand Luke, which JLEM, Jack Lemmon's production company, produced, and he was supposed to have played Luke, but he was one that realized he's wrong for the role, and Paul Newman was right for the role. So here are two roles right in a row, 66 and 67, which could have been Jack Lemmon's, who was certainly still a big star. Would have been interesting to see him in these two roles. I don't know if he even had a chance at the Burton role, but effectively he turned down Cool Hand Luke.
Well, I know also that Martha could have been played by Bette Davis. That was their initial choice, and when they bought the rights from Edward Albee, that's who they told him was going to play Martha, and he loved it.
What a dump.
Which is a quote from Bette Davis, a Bette Davis movie.
What's the movie that it's from?
Oh, I can't remember.
I don't think I've even
Did
seen
they even
it. It's not
figure
famous.
It out? Oh, no, okay.
Beyond the Forest.
That's it. Oh, my gosh. So she would have been quoting her own movie, and I wouldn't want to see anyone but Richard Burton play George at this point. To me, he is perfect. But oh my god, can you imagine Bette Davis playing Martha? That would be incredible. I would love, love, love to have seen that. It will obviously never happen.
Her Margot Channing in All About Eve is one of the most famous and beloved characters. We talked about it in All About Eve. She was only in the movie for about 30 or 35 minutes.
Oh god, but she's so amazing in it. Mm-hmm. And actually, Virginia Woolf kind of reminded me a little of All About Eve as well. That was another film that I was made to think of when I was watching this.
One little trivia piece about her too is that apparently in that movie she doesn't say, "What a dump," in that over the top way, but then when people would ask her to later on, she would. She played along with that.
Oh, God bless her.
The director, the guy we talked about so much in the beginning of the podcast, Mike Nichols. This is his first movie, period. So it's his first AFI movie. His next movie is his other one. That's The Graduate. And the rest of his filmography, we've already covered that. Fred Zinnemann, who did High Noon and From Here to Eternity way back for us, was the original director, but he made A Man for All Seasons instead. And that was the movie that won the Best Picture and Best Director, Best Actor, Oscars, the same year this movie came out. It's a fine film, but this one's way better in my opinion.
Yeah, I like Man for All Seasons, but my God, especially over the years, which one's aged better?
Many of the films we talked about, what won the Oscar for Best Picture and what didn't, what movie do people really talk about anymore? And in this case, it's certainly Virginia Woolf. I like Nichols' directorial choices, too. The handheld camera, which we haven't seen very much of. Maybe we've seen it here and there. Well, Manchurian Candidate did things like that. Very tight close-ups, sometimes out of focus. Sometimes you'd see them literally racking focus right then and there.
Because they're drunk. It's like a drunk's POV.
But it also might have been accidents. There's a great commentary with Nichols and Steven Soderbergh, who acts as his host on the DVD. If you ever want to spend 2 hours and 10 minutes after you've seen the movie hearing more about it, then I recommend it. And in that, he has a discussion about his problems, and many people have had problems with the cinematographer Haskell Wexler, but we'll get into that in a few minutes. Ooh. You want to talk about Nichols on the stage.
He was a stage director first. He was a director in the theater.
And he worked with Elaine May, who became a writer and a director in Hollywood movies.
Mm-hmm. They were partners.
The LB play was adapted by Ernest Lehman, his fourth AFI film, and so many of them have been recently. North by Northwest, West Side Story, Sound of Music, all within the last several months. Lehman was also the uncredited producer. He had enough stroke to get this rough subject matter onto the screen. Burton and Taylor, interestingly, didn't like Lehman's changes, so they used Albee's original words. I'm not sure how much they used from Lehman's changes, but I read something about how it was, "Let's go to the Roadhouse and let's leave the Roadhouse."
But otherwise pretty loyal to the play.
Well, you know, if all he did was have that stroke as a producer to get this on the screen with the new director and the two contentious stars, Taylor's reputation was not the greatest at that point. If that's all he contributed to this movie, then that's enough.
And leave this script. Leave the play as is. Let the genius show of Albee's play.
Yeah. Before we get into the behind the scenes people, let's talk a little bit more about plots and themes and things like that. We've said so much about Taylor's appearance. She gained 30 pounds. She pulled the De Niro. That's a lot of weight for a woman to gain. But the reverse of that would be vomiting, would it not? There's a segue for you. Honey vomits in this movie twice. And I don't know if it's in the play. Maybe she goes off stage when that happens. Can you confirm that?
Definitely. Okay. Yeah.
But when she leaves, that gives us an opportunity to split the characters up a little bit. And that also gives Burton an opportunity to have scenes with everybody else. Mm-hmm. And she is in the movie the least, for sure. Honey is.
I will say, if anybody were to actually try to match them drink for drink, the way that they pounded back in this movie, they would be in the hospital. It's an insane amount of
alcohol. I lost track. We should watch this movie again sometime and do a counter for it. I'm not saying we should follow them drink for drink. Maybe sip for sip. That might, we'd still get as blitzed. But just count how many drinks are poured.
Oh, it's insane. They're constantly pouring drinks. And a lot of this is in real time. If anybody actually drank like that, they'd be dead.
Yeah, and they've already been drinking all night at the party, for sure. So maybe that's not the most authentic thing. But there are some other authentic touches I really liked. You get Taylor talking with her mouth full when she got the piece of chicken from the fridge. And then Burton has buried his face in the pillow when they're in the bedroom before the other two even come over. And he's talking and she's yelling. She can't understand what he's saying. People do those kinds of things, though. And again, the movies are changing. It would have been before. You very clearly have to talk, unless you're Howard Hawksworth with the overlapping dialogue, and Robert Altman. We've already mentioned him on the podcast. Here he is again. Very famously had overlapping dialogue, and it was hard to sometimes hear what people are saying. We're guilty of that sometimes on this podcast.
The set had a lot of authenticity, too. Like, it was messy. It was dirty. There was dirt in the kitchen.
Clutter.
Clutter. And it just felt so natural and real.
Yeah, Richard Sobert and George James Hopkins did the sets. They both did 4 AFI movies.
Apparently, they went to the East Coast to shoot it for authenticity, and Nichols later said it was a waste of time.
Even though they're mostly indoors, They went to Northampton, Massachusetts. Interesting choice. That may have been the rookie director.
Yeah, then, that's true.
And maybe Lehman backed him up and said, well, okay, I'm with you, man. Well, after the immense scale of some of our recent AFI films, like last week's Dr. Zhivago, and Sound of Music wasn't that long ago. And in fact, it was only the week before, but we split it up because we did Dog Day Afternoon. This is as intimate as it's going to get. Because, again, it's the bottle episode kind of thing going on here. two other points I want to make, and we'll move on to the tech people a little bit more. One is the gun umbrella gag, as I'm calling it. The umbrella turns into a gun. That's dark and funny, but they set it up like he might actually shoot her. That's still pretty early. Again, we're really late at night, but in their time together, the four of them, it's still pretty early. But it's set up as if, okay, maybe he's really going to shoot her with a shotgun.
You might believe that if you don't know enough about the play, you might believe that it's all going to turn into a hostage situation of some kind. Like this man's been pushed over the edge and they have to stop him from killing everybody in the room.
That's also when Nick and Honey should bail. And yes. If he wasn't just trying to get his career moved ahead, which is what he is, he's an opportunist, then they would have. And even though I'm sure there were never guns or gunbrellas in this relationship I'm about to mention, my aunt and uncle, when they were together way back when, they had a passionate relationship in the kind of way that we see here where they're often fighting. I think that mostly came out when they were drunk. They were a good match, generally, but not when they were drinking too much. Probably an age-old story for a lot of people, actually.
I mean to you all the time, even when I'm sober.
It never ends. But I never choke you like George does to Martha in the Roadhouse.
Yeah, I think if they were going to remake this film now, they might rethink the clear domestic abuse. It's just something that would be much more controversial now than it would have been in the 60s.
I'm sure in the 60s a lot of people would watch that movie, even women, but certainly men, and say, well, she had it coming.
Yeah, she's awful. What's even crazier is that after he tries to kill her, she gets her breath back and the first thing she says is she berates him. You know, she's right back at him. She's not afraid of him at all, even though he clearly proves twice that he can overpower her completely.
If not for Nick, he might have actually done it. Who knows?
Yeah, he seems to have pushed that far.
Here's a question to ask, though, that's probably been asked by everybody. Is all of this that they're doing, including that, the strangling, a show for these two people?
I mean, we do see
them before the other two come over, and they're already fighting. They're already on each other. But we know the son is a gag, a lie, a ruse. How much of the stuff where they really get on each other, really hitting each other hard, not literally, is it not possible?
I think they're mean to each other in private, but you can just amp it up when there's other people around, because then it's not just the insults, it's the humiliation. And he says to her at one point, you know, when it's just you and I can numb myself. But when you do it in front of other people, I just simply can't take it. So I think that she invites Nick and Honey over just because she wants to hurt George. Because she knows that if she yells at him in private, it's not going to get to him the same way it would if there were witnesses.
Okay. We haven't talked about the ending, actually, yet, about the revelation that the sun never existed. It's not exactly one of the great revelations. We talked on the Planet of the Apes podcast about the great twist endings, and that was just an opinion piece. What did you think was the best one? And we both had our thoughts about that.
Yeah, the one bad review on Rotten Tomatoes, he didn't buy that whole thing. He thought it was like an unnecessary add-on that just to give them some kind of ending.
Okay. I don't know where else the story necessarily... Well, there's a ton of places you could take the story, actually. I shouldn't say I don't know where it could go. But here's some subtext for what they did do with it. The telegram that George and Sis came, of course we know there's no telegram, about the death of the son. Now that's a precursor to what was going to come in Vietnam, where an awful lot of parents, an awful lot of mothers were getting telegrams telling them that their sons were dead in a foreign country.
That's a good point.
Now I don't know that they did that for that reason, because Vietnam for America wasn't truly a war yet.
Especially not when the play was written in 62.
So an unintentional precursor to that. And in that scene, Burton, off camera, is the director. He's coaching her. George is coaching Martha a lot of the time with what to say. Now, I know that's what was written. I'm not suggesting that the actor is actually doing it for the actress, but it's just a curious thing. It's almost like Nichols is behind the camera saying this, and they just dubbed in Burton later. Again, I'm not saying they did that, but you get this whole subtextual thing where you get the other actor saying, no, do it this way, say it this way. And she plays along. And then her sobs at the end, they almost got to me. Taylor sells those tears and that sobbing. Talk about how people can find it in themselves to cry. Whoa, I don't know how she got to that place.
And the second George wins this night-long battle that he's having with Martha, he comforts her.
Then he's tender with her.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. He won that battle, and he's immediately her husband, like her loving husband again. They need each other.
Pretty sick, though.
I know. I love that in the end, they come back together. That detail that their marriage probably isn't going to end, and that this is just part of what they do.
And they might do it again. It's a vicious circle. I've said it a few times already. It's kind of cynical. You said before about the theater of the absurd and the cynicality of Albee. I think that plays into that, too. Okay, the people that made the film behind that camera, and it is a black and white film if we didn't say this already, this is the last B&W flick until the last picture show, 12 AFI movies from now. We're going to get an awful lot of color, although some are kind of gritty and grimy. A lot of those westerns and The Wild Bunch and Easy Rider, not exactly a lot of big Technicolor-type films the way we've been seeing lately, but here's the last black and white film. They use it well, too.
They probably had to do black and white in order to get those handheld camera shots. You would never get a camera operator to have a Technicolor camera. Like, they were enormous. They had to run three different reels of film at the same time. So, and to get that gritty look.
You also need more light for Technicolor.
And it's all like a kind of small environment inside the house.
In the opening scene when they're walking away from the party going to back to their house during the opening credits, I looked at you and thought, I hope it's not this grainy the whole way through. It's a special edition DVD I bought a long time ago. It's not the Blu-ray. And I thought, this doesn't look this bad, does it? I haven't seen it in quite a while. No, the rest of the movie looks very fine, actually.
Yeah, it's just that opening shot.
And I guess I had to crank open the iris or something for the outside shot. So the man shooting this black and white film with that grain in the beginning, Haskell Wexler, he's going to shoot In the Heat of the Night, which is next week. How about that? And he also did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, one of the couple of cinematographers, actually. And he consulted on American Graffiti. So a lot of AFI work for him. He did a ton of other movies, won a couple of Oscars. And he did battle with Mike Nichols. As a common theme for Wexler, it wasn't the first time that ever happened. I have a feeling, as an aspiring director, and he did direct films like Medium Cool, not long after this one, that he just simply wanted to do things his way and did not want to be told what to do by the man in charge.
He was a passionate, fiery artist.
And this is the last time the Oscars for black and white and color cinematography were separate categories. 1967 and beyond, it was just one. The editor, Sam Osteen, did three AFI films. The Graduate is next for him, the other Nichols film, and Chinatown. He also did a movie I mentioned that I just recently watched, Cool Hand Luke. Pretty good cutter. Although he had a fairly easy job in this movie because of all the long takes. And there's not that many cuts anyway. Some of these scenes go on a long time. Very theater-esque.
It doesn't feel that way because the dialogue's so snappy and quick, and also the camera's so close and it's following the actors. It's really very kinetic.
And you've used this word a lot in the project, the mise-en-scène.
Because it's an appropriate term.
The blocking is key in a movie like this. If you're going to have a movie that's basically a photograph stage play, then you got to have your actors doing something somewhat dynamic and moving around.
People never give actors credit for this, but it is so hard to memorize your lines, feel it, get into the part, and then still be professional enough to hit your mark so that the focus puller can get it right. That's hard to do, so kudos to them for that.
There's an art to that, yeah. Mm-hmm. The composer, Alex North, we talked about Streetcar, well, he did that one, and Spartacus, two other AFI films. And he had the unused score for 2001. We're going to talk about that when we do that film, not that long from now. We've often talked about music. This one's a pretty subtle one, pretty unobtrusive. You okay with this one?
I could have done without.
You just hate music and movies, I guess.
Not always.
Just wait till we get the John Williams music.
I think it would have been great, sparse, and without music, except for the incidental songs.
There's not that much of it, though.
No, there's mercifully little.
It's mostly just a bridging device between the scenes.
Probably the last scene would have missed it as well, if you were to make it with no music.
The costumer, Irene Sharaf, won 5 Academy Awards. She also did West Side Story and The Best Years of Our Lives, so she's got some black and white and big-budget Technicolor experience under her belt. Let's get to some influence. There's probably a ton of it, and I've got 3 in particular. Carnage, the movie that was made a few years ago with Kate Winslet, John C. Reilly, Jodie Foster, and Christoph Waltz. A movie I liked an awful lot. Very funny, very savage. I've seen it a few times, and I'm a big fan of that movie. I think it's very good. Very short, too, but also takes place in one apartment and a hallway, although we also see the opening and closing, the two kids that are real in this case, the very beginning, the very ending, but otherwise the story takes place in that one apartment and just outside in the hallway. Revolutionary Road, Kate Winslet again, and Leonardo DiCaprio movie by Sam Mendes quite a few years ago. Little comparisons there with their tough relationship. And then many TV shows have used the battling couple as the basis for an episode, including a show we've mentioned so often, The Simpsons, where Marge and Homer go away on that retreat to try to fix their marriage, and there's another couple that are there that is based on George and Martha. And I'm sure our listeners might have a ton more I haven't mentioned right now.
Yeah, it's kind of a genre in itself, the troubled marriage movie. Mm-hmm. But it existed long before Virginia Woolf.
All right, so the Oscar list is immense. It won 5. Best Actress for Elizabeth Taylor, Supporting Actress for Sandy Dennis, Cinematography for Wexler, the sets that I mentioned already, and the costumes for Sharaf. The 8 nominations it didn't win was for Best Picture, Best Director for Nichols, Best Actor for Burton. How did that not happen? But Paul Scofield won for A Man for All Seasons. Supporting Actor for George Segal, the script that they apparently didn't even use that was adapted from Albee's original play.
They should have just given the award to Albee.
Well, they didn't win the award anyway.
Oh, yeah.
The editing, the sound, and the music. The booze is alive with the sound of music. The movie made the National Film Registry just last year in 2013.
Yeah, I saw that. I was a little surprised.
It took a long time for it to rank there.
It was a more beloved film than that.
Nearly a quarter of a century before they finally recognized it. 2 other AFI mentions. 89th on Top 100 Passions. Why is this movie not a lot higher than that? But then, you know what? Dr. Zhivago, we talked about it. We're not fans, especially you, of the kind of passions that list represents. And this is a good example. Passion isn't about, I love you, kiss me at the end. Although, spoiler alert on that list, most of the top 10, they don't end up together. Somebody or both of them die, or they just don't end up together.
Yeah, at least George and Martha end up together.
And passion is not about, kiss me, I love you, let's go to the bedroom. It is about fiery sometimes. It is about, I hate you, but I also am married to you. It is about inspiring powerful urges to do bad things sometimes to each other. That, to me, is passion. People misuse that word all the time. Passion, people think, oh, it means you want to sleep with somebody. No, that isn't necessarily what it means. Sometimes it means that. Sometimes it means something completely apart from that. Anyway, the last AFI-ness, 62nd on the Top 100 Quotes list with, what a dump!
Which is funny, because it's a quote from another movie.
Yeah, and they showed them both on that show. They showed Beyond the Forest version and the Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf version. That brings us to the end of the podcast. What are your last thoughts on a movie that I know you loved, and so do I?
Yeah, I obviously am a huge fan of this movie. I'm thrilled that it's on the list. I would never call it a perfect film. It has its flaws. It's a little too hysterical. But still, it's just so full of wit and such genius performances. It's just one of those cases where everybody was at the top of their game. I would have put it higher than 67th, and it's a crime that it wasn't put on the list back in the 90s.
And it's one of the few from the 2007 version that was an improvement on the original. Mm-hmm. So a great film. If you're a movie fan, you've probably seen it. And if you haven't, go rent it or buy it right now.
If you're a language fan, such a wonderfully written film.
And it's probably one of those that gets put on the stage over and over again as the years have gone on. So check it out in the theater, according to Bev. That's worth your while as well. All right, so next week on the Top 100 Project is Norman Jewison's Racial Powder Keg. I said it already, In the Heat of the Night. You haven't seen that one, have you?
No, never.
Best Picture winner from 1967. That is a good year for movies. Four AFI movies are on that list. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for In the Heat of the Night. Mr. Tibbs was 19th on the Heroes and Villains list. How many other people of color, any color other than white, any color, are on the list as either a hero or a villain?
Ooh, that's a good question. All right, so for the answer to that, tune in next week to our In the Heat of the Night podcast. We have lots more trivia, links to some of the things we've talked about today, and lots of other fun stuff on our website. Please check it out. It's top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. We'd love to hear what you think of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and any of the other films we've talked about on the project. Please give us a shout. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Let's go get some bourbon.
Never mix, never worry.